new collection came and talk about collections and groups of works on the way through to see his Table of Dynasties, which is an amazing collection of 1,652 canvases. Have some of you seen the new tag already? Or some of you have? Justin, certainly. Well, let's come to the top of the stairs and we'll start. To landscape, one of, I think, Canterbury's favourite subjects, and collections of reused, recycled plastic bags. We've got another big work through that also takes reused and recycled plastic and uses it as its material. Let's come through. As director of a gallery, some of you might think that I might have a view of collections that is very fixed and stable. I've worked with several collections, Queensland Art Gallery, National Gallery of Australia, the National Gallery in New Zealand, which is now part of Te Papa, and this one, and they all have their different characters. They've started at different times, they've had different requests, they've had an interest in different areas, they've had different budgets. And I think they've had different points of view about what is right for a collection of its time. This part of our new collection hang shows what we didn't collect at the beginning because we weren't, this gallery was started in the 1930s. Although the Canterbury Society of Arts collected for us before that, we didn't have many of these sorts of early landscapes or portraits of early Māori at all. There was nothing like that in our collection. It was considered to be important to collect British and European works. And I think one of the things that I'm fascinated about in this particular collection is what we've had to borrow and where there are artists too, like Fiona Partington, who've delved into the taxonomic collections of museums and made art out of them. And I think groupings of works like this made into art are fascinating. I'm sure, John, you too enjoy looking at museum collections. And
absolutely, Jenny. I think that one of the things, if I may be so bold, you know, what I think that when we first walk into a room like this, we're straight away we've been invited to dance, where we're invited to take, is a framing of a certain point of departure. And this is what we see in a room like this, and we realise that ahead of us lies an argument, a song about collecting, and that reflects back on our own sense of familiarity with artworks, but also what the gallery and what the collection will draw from us in terms of new experiences and new stories. So this is, I think this is a markedly different room from where we started, from where we end up in.
Yes. And of course, the whole architecture is different too. And certainly, I reviewed the Christchurch Art Gallery both for Architecture New Zealand and for the Bulletin of New Zealand Art History shortly after it opened. Of course, I had no idea I was going to be its director in a few years' time. But one of the things I remarked on was how the collection galleries upstairs seemed to be rather static and sedate, and it felt to me a little bit like the Robert McDougall Gallery, beloved by everyone, had been picked up from the gardens and popped in the new building. And I think it felt like that model hadn't been rethought. So part of what we wanted to do with this new collection development and new display was open up the spaces a bit more, show some rather large works, one of which is by John, which we couldn't have accommodated in the old spaces, and open up the sense and the stories of art history. So I think, well, we've been through, and few of you have, and I think we've definitely done things differently, haven't we?
Yes, yes. And that particular pull between contemporary and prior performances will become apparent as we move through the rooms. So
let's go through here. So. Now, one of the things that we've done here is put together a group of drawings by Teo Schoon. Some of these are in the Canterbury Museum's collection. They probably weren't thought of as art at all when they were first made. He was recording images of rock art in South Canterbury that he had seen, and he was recording them somewhat fluidly and not necessarily thinking or making something that anyone thought of as art at the time. I mean, I guess we would have collected them if we'd thought that, but instead, these things being thought of more as archive tend to go into museum collections because museums are interested in the rock drawings and things. However, artist Gordon Walters was very interested in Teo Schoon and met him and began to use these similar Maori motifs and use them centrally. And here we have Richard Killeen. Now, I know John's got something of great interest to say about Richard Killeen, because here we have a collection of broken up.
Absolutely. What thrills me about this work by Rick is, first, at scale, but also a great sense of familiarity. I spent some time with Rick in the early 90s when he was assembling a kind of grab bag of imagery and symbols with which he's explored in this work. And what I used to have some issue with Rick's work was what I call a problem with the egalitarianism, that New Zealand sense that of horizontality. And Rick's, I mean, there's a great democracy at play here. He puts everything up in a very loose kind of a breeziness of a hook next to a something Pacific, something from the Book of Kells, bang against each other. So that sort of chemistry seems to be played out again with Bill Talbot, and we could argue with the Table of Dynasties. So this seems to be, we could almost claim, there seems to be a strategy that is alive and well in contemporary art practice in New Zealand. This desire to puzzle, to filch, to blur, to then hang out to dry. And I think this is a magnificent work by Rick, and it's great that it's been flanked by Teo and Gordon, both important figures in the pathanon of art making in New Zealand for Rick. And the work, curiously, although the problem, if you like, and I use that word as a compliment, I have with Rick's work, or the issue, I suppose I should say, he presents a sort of democracy of play. At the same time, it's tremendously assertive, and I think that's the triumph of the work. There's this, and it's an insistence upon something that may seem initially, when we approach it as viewers, to drift and to be less categorized, or a blurring down of category and source, if you like. But he's making a new present. He's charting our rich past from the Northern Hemisphere and from our Pacific locale.
He too has gone to museums and looked at collections, pulled out the drawers of butterflies and moths earlier than this, but using things that he's seen all over the place and bringing them into to a single piece.
And it's an intuitive engagement, because he's asking the museum, of course, to nominate, does the fork go next to the horse? Does the horse go next to the weird fish face? I mean, so there's a generosity in that too, isn't there?
So there's a freedom in how we hang the work. when we show it here. Usually he says they should be so far apart, or but they can be shown in different ways each time they go on display. They become a new work, in a sense.
Well, you could imagine it as a frieze right around the, you know, an attenuated work, kind of a more sort of categorised narrative, if you like. But
yes,
yes.
Could we do that? But they do stack into boxes, don't they? Anyway, this is one point I think about one of the new works that we've hung, relatively new works that we've hung in the space. We've seen it in other spaces, but it certainly looks different here where it's got such a good length of distance between it. I'd just like to look at these two works before we... John, these works, Promison, which was in the MCAT, Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Culture, Foreign Affairs and Trade, I'm sorry, collection. This is the first time it's been seen, in fact, in this in Christchurch, but it was a gift from them to us. And the Sutton, a lovely Sutton, not one I knew about until I saw it here, because, of course, we've got quite a few things in our storage that rotate and come in and out of shows. But I'm really impressed with the way that, aside from Promison, this work looks menacing, surrealistic. The sky looks quite extraordinary. It's interesting how things play with each other in a gallery space, depending on what you, how you choose to put them, where you choose to put them.
Absolutely. I think there's a favourite book of mine on writing is by a Canadian writer, Margaret Atwood, and the book's called Negotiating with the Dead. I think that that's what all artists at some stage in their lives and careers must do, that someone like myself has a problem with macabre. Now, you play that out, you tease it out as an artist, because negotiating with the dead is how you activate the present. And Bill, of course, I think that both of these works demonstrate that sort of New Zealand God-bothering problem we have with landscape. And God bless them. I mean,
it's
that's right. Well, and Bill, maybe.
And
even.
Bill, yes.
It seems to be an issue we have, and we're fraught and we're tenuous in this beautiful place where we find ourselves stuck in. And this is precisely the kind of analogy and fix that this kind of context, and as Jenny said, this kind of collision of projects, the Promison and the Sutton, can activate in the curious viewer.
So it's something we'll be bringing up later when we look at John's work, the different relationships of the different canvases. But first, let's look at Bill's.
This, I'm going to be so bold as to take a talking here. I'd almost describe this as being the beating heart of the show in a strange sense, and of course that's possibly not quite fair to pick one word, but this work seems to, as we walk into the room, it draws us in, and it's an ocean, of course. It's flotsam, and it's we too are as we are as an island nation, we're adrift in the South Pacific, and there's this cavalcade of gorgeous, plastic, non-corroding containers, and it seems to happily celebrate one of the more despairing aspects of the human condition, that is, we're drowning in our own muck. But what Bill manages to do is he seems to freight a number of lines in with regard to a kind of an understanding of our current global anxieties with a deeply decorative and luscious work. Here he is throwing light out, and there's that beautiful hazy secondary reflection that for me seems to rehearse the quality of waves, when you're out on the ocean, the way they just slap and bang against each other, and all these lovely drifting plastic. And some of them, of course, are serrated, like they're cut off, which seems to support that contention that they're floating somewhere out in the ocean. I always find, I know some people are distressed on the great New Zealand beaches when they find Korean buoys and strange things thrown up, sea wreck. I mean, I always find the giddy plastic colours in our magnificent landscape is somehow energising. It's the crap we come with, but it's ours, and it's who would put those colours together? What manufacturer chose that purple, that lime green? It's sumptuous and it's banal, and so we have that somewhere in here is Warhol, I suppose. There's a number of kind of prior practices, but it does have that quality which we've talked a little bit with the Killeen. It's a work that is a convolution and a collection of moments, and together it makes something rhapsodic. And of course, it's framed by this magnificent space, and it spills out into the rest of the show in this magnificent way.
It looks terrific here. This is certainly one of the works we couldn't have shown in the old spaces, and so we're really delighted to have this. And it's actually a really nicely proportioned space, I think. Whatever we do in here next, it will look good. Bill, of course, collects these things from rubbish dumps and various other places, so it's interesting to find artists taking their content, if you like, from all sorts of different places, literally in this case from rubbish dumps and simple electric lighting systems, in Rick Levine's case from museums and different places like that, and so different taxonomies, different groups of things become art transformed in this way.
I think we almost want that in terms of contemporary practice. I read this lovely description of James Joyce, but when asked where does he get his, you know, where does one find material? And he immediately responded, it's when you trip over in the street and you bend down and pick up a note, a shopping list from someone. It's that, so many contemporary artists, you almost lower the view. So, you know, we come from perhaps a number of strategies where the artist seems to be looking out into the world bravely, boldly, with a sense of ambition. And nowadays, the contemporary performance so often seems to be stumbling around in an iniquitous space where, you know, like a trap. Bill Calvert in the south of France, in his favourite dump, looking for plastic. And yet, he takes that, like a magpie, and presents this treasure to us in this rich way. And what a great role. I mean,
what a great source.
What a great source.
All right, let's walk on through. Now with Table of Dynasties, which is John's work. John, let us hang we didn't hang it. Now, why isn't it hanging? Tell me that.
Well, of course, the clue to this work is its title. It's called Table of Dynasties. And when we first showed it, it was intended for an art fair in Hong Kong. And the strategy, or my one small bright idea, was to somehow to go back into the East, back to China, and set up a Shanghai street trader's table and sell their wares back to them. In other words, these little canvases are all made in China. They've come to New Zealand. We wish to take them back, loved up, you know, value added, export, if you will, back towards the great mothership of the global economy at the moment. And so what happily, very happily for me, Justin and the team here have done is open up another kind of play with the work. In the sense, it's got an our CinemaScope 3D blockbuster feel, which is happily succeeded very well. It's no longer a little street stall in Shanghai, over rich and tumbling. It's something expansive and lurching and pixelated and glorious. And it's not for me to say that, obviously, but I'm very happy, I'm trying to say. It's like it's almost like a pier going out into the ocean. It's this marvellous sense of departure and arrival. It seems to have a beginning and an end, but maybe it doesn't. It's just a sausage with a string in the middle. I mean, it's glorious to see the work like this, because for me, it's like meeting it again for the first time. It's like it has its own wild energy, which I have nothing to do with, and it's a thrill.
Fantastic. Well, people I've seen coming through here, I came twice yesterday and saw people walk through here and go, wow. And then I also heard people down in the cafe saying they've put a curved wall in. And the fascinating thing is we've always had a curved wall, but obviously it hasn't been quite as apparent to some viewers as it is now with this table.
Well, I think, Jenny, your earlier point you made about how this new space has offered opportunities to gear up and get leverage for certain works, the Bill Carpet, obviously, we've just come from, well, this is, again, the work has been extended with this opportunity, with this wall, with the staging. So, you know, that's a very real, that's right there is the way museums work, the play of them, the way they stage, the way they frame, the way they can tease out meanings and readings for an audience. You know, that's just as good as it gets.
We mischievously thought of another couple of places to put this work when we were having coffee together before, and we certainly thought it could go between the pillars and be read on either side. You could put these canvases straight along there, and they might turn up there one day with a different life.
Well, I think what would happen there, and that's the sort of 360-degree experience we had in Hong Kong, and what that managed to do, if I can be so bold, you get to see the back of the canvas, which is a way of, oh, look at that, there's a yellow dot, well done. and that displays the kind of, it's like going around the back of the Hollywood sign and seeing, oh, it's just scaffold and bits of old plywood. So, there's another instability that can be played with in that 360 kind of thing. So. But, one of the great pleasures of seeing that sort of speculation happening in the context of an institution and for a contemporary artist is to have that great sense of warmth that the work might be loved up in this collection and it might get airing. And, that is the dream, of course, for us, because so often work, which is it's a tenuous business, teasing it out, so often it can end up in a collection or in a boxes somewhere or on the studio floor. So the sense that somehow it's become, it's been embraced and drawn into a wider kind of conversation, and it can hold its own in the context of some extraordinary work is immensely
satisfying.
Very
rewarding. Yeah. Good. Well, we've talked about the origins and where artists look for their material, and of course you've looked at a dictionary here, another sort of taxonomy,
yes.
A dictionary of art historical terms.
Yes, let me just describe one of my, I talked about that sort of the issue Rick might have. One of the kind of things that seems to be emerging for me, and I say seem because I'm trying to resist it, is a certain violence to books, which I seem to be stuck on. There's an unpicking process where I take a dictionary and I refuse to accept its structure. Obviously, these are terms, over 1,600 terms from a dictionary, but not the definitions. And part of my motivation there is a fantastic statement I took from Borges, who gave an address in America a decade or so back, and he said, we as an audience, we as readers, must misread the text. We must misunderstand the book. And I've taken that as the green light to take things like the Oarsman Dictionary, or in this case, Lucy Smith's Thames and Hudson's Dictionary of Art Terms, as an opportunity to boldly step away from that particularly wonderful attention we all have when we have a book in our hands and we have set up that tremendously vibrant space, and to rip the thing apart and disperse it through the mechanics of the two-dimensional visual art. So. I guess for an artist, I said violence to a book, and I really, that word is quite, I think that if there's too much, how can I say this, one of the things, I guess there's several unpickings going on, because what I, where's a nice word? Drop leaf front or surrealism or Greek vases or zeitgeist, at the same time as unpicking the dictionary, of course I'm unpicking a way we might be attentive. When we walk through a museum, we have a certain kind of radar and nerve endings up with regard to readings and meanings and experiences. And this work, almost just as it rattles off, it wishes to collapse that process too. It wishes to deny that process because it's using the vocabulary of meaning and reading in a kind of a dumb way. So it's bright and it's stupid simultaneously. And somewhere between those cracks and those kind of parameters, there's this very kind of gentle caressing of the processes of where meaning might be. And as an artist, I quite like these works and working on these small canvases because they allow me a way of producing work that's the closest to reading. I'm sitting down, I'm not standing at a wall or an easel, I'm sitting down, there's a little lamp, there's a book, there's a pen, there's a canvas, and I'm writing. So I'm as close as I possibly can to being that rehearsing, that gentle kind of conversation reader and book has. At the same time, I'm creating this dumb kind of Sisyphean kind of task, which seemingly has no end or no structure yet. And there's an obsessive and somewhat thoughtless kind of quality to it. So it's a very odd thing to do. And the whisper it's making to the audience is, where does this collating go? Where does this collecting go? What's been collected? Where is the meaning? So hopefully in that sense of a larger collection, that's a very valid kind of loop.
So we've got the option of reading here as well as looking. I'm just
wondering. Damn words. I mean, it's the curse. As a painter, I make that claim somewhat anxiously. Words again. Words. A text in painting and contemporary practice is we're all. There's a gnashing of teeth in the background. As an audience, we go, "Oh God, another New Zealand artwork with text and so forth." And as an artist, you go, "Oh God, I can't." Because one of the things I did want to sort of tease this out a little bit. One of the things as an artist you have is a number of balls in the air. There's a number of projects which are sort of vying for one's attention. And this work came up with regard to Hong Kong seemed to say, pick me, pick me. So you try and resist the work coming to fruition, because in that resistance comes the true shape or the seductive appeal of pursuing it. And so as an artist, you're both asked, you have two hats. You have the trying to generate activity at the same time trying to corral it. So they're all sheep. And you don't have a dog, and they're aberrant and truculent, and you're trying to get them through some sort of portal you don't know the shape of. So, as an artist, it's a kind of a form of blindness in a way. And Roland Barthes used to describe that, where he said, "How to proceed? Will you proceed blindly?" And I think again, I made that little issue with regard to Bill Talbot of trip, you're tripping down, and yeah. I think that's what. If I look down, I find myself looking at a book. Well, that's valid material or text. That's what you work with. So there's a paucity, just at the same time as richness has been freighted. So
just a really prosaic question. You get a dictionary.
And I go, oh no, another dictionary. No.
I mean, do you choose a word or a phrase every second page, or how do you put it in a computer? I mean, how does it work? Because some of these are full terms.
Yes.
Still life, obviously. Yeah. I've got no idea what FFF is. I don't know what that means.
It's a Tourette's-like punctuation, but it's a term printmakers use, it's a folio. Folio.
Yes, editor. Folio. That's
so it's
right.
Official, but I see it as swearing.
I know. I know that I've heard of the Hudson River School, and I know what Greek vases are.
And the Hairy Who is down there somewhere, and there's Blind Arcade, which is a nice way to lead off.
Yes.
So, what you've just described.
Where's this come from? Westwork.
Westwork, exactly.
We know what copy means.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, you know, I'm tooling up. You know, it's a dumb work in the sense that there I am, in a room learning about the business and furiously learning, turning the page of a dictionary and trying to, what is solar?
This is the dictionary of art history.
Yes.
So you're placing yourself in that.
Desperately running, you know, like blindly trying to catch up and. What is the Harry Who? I can't remember what the Harry Who. I think they were Chicago School. The question though is quite good because I bashed into this when I was taking on the 15,000 terms in the Orsman Dictionary. Is what kind of editorial strategy does one use? And with regards to this, again, there's this kind of bipolar process of trying to be to be drawn to the poetry of the terms you like. At the same time, trying to stand back and refuse to have, your own wild, to be true to the book in a way, to allow the emphasis the book has fruition. So the one luxury I had was to mispresent, because all dictionaries present order. They start at A, they end at Z, so that's it. And they categorize and they particularize. And what I'm doing here is conforming but refusing to conform. So it's in that collision of the desire for order and the insistence on disorder that I fall in that gap. And so I trip myself up trying to be true to the book at the same time riffing on the wild poetry of the terms that are in there. And again, misunderstanding or misreading the text. So,
Deliberately,
yeah. Vacuously and vivaciously. And you do learn.
So have you seen people with walking past and reading and... what do you people do, ones of you who've been here already? Do you tend to engage and read several canvases and then move on and think you'll see some more next time?
One of the things we found in Hong Kong is that people would walk towards it, like stunned, and their hand reached out. They'd wish to pick something up because they're kind of pretty little things, and they got that gigaw quality that you could just take one home. But somehow there's so many of them sporing that you stand back at the same time. But
I must say we were a little bit worried when we bought this.
I think
what the conservators and registrars might feel because of the 1,652 canvases, and yes, they are easy to pick up.
I think it's one of the greatest compliments as an artist is to have your work stolen. I think it seems to be someone can't not
do
live
not
with
spread
something.
This message.
No, well, I remember as a young art student, I can confess this because we're in public and we're in safety. I was at the Auckland Art Gallery late in the day, and I was all of 20, I suppose, 18, and there was a particularly beautiful Macan lunch scroll work on paper, and there was no one round, and those are the days before CCTV, I'm sure. And I stood there looking, and I said, I'm this close, I could get closer, and I did, and I could sniff it, and I thought, this is extraordinary. I could just roll this up. I could. And there was this, the tease of the transgression, the desire to just to shoplift, at the same time, this immense sense of, I'd get caught, because I'd be glowing, you know, and it was, of course, I felt like an altar boy caught sipping this altar wine in some way. It was passion. One could be forgiven because I was an art student and I just wanted to rub that thing.
To have and to own,
yeah,
yes.
But of course, so I stepped back, thankfully, and here I am today. But, I think it's also also a trick of this work, and I'm happy to claim this, that the allure of working in this way is that these things are grabbable. And I almost want that you wish the viewers. One of the anxieties all museums have and all artists have is what I sort of call the museum distance. And one of the things we want to tease out is that proximity, is to get the viewer curious and then to get them closer. And frames do that. Small scale and large space do that. Because the moment, and all of you'll know this, the moment you get past a critical distance with regard to works, you can sniff them. And I got caught sniffing a Mondrian in the Museum of Modern Art once. And some guards moved towards me with certain, about. I put my arms behind my back. But this isn't the first time I bumped into a Mondrian, and there was a little cluster of them. And I couldn't believe how ugly they were. They were tremendous, because growing up in New Zealand, you know, we have the beautiful offset printed books, and they're glorious and smooth. And
they look perfect.
They
and
look
modern
perfect.
And real Mondrians.
Yeah.
No, are made.
No,
yeah,
no, and
they've
got paint.
They've got,
And so there I was, you know, I couldn't believe it. And the guards were inching closer and closer, step away from the answer. So, but that is a key moment, because artworks are not inert, and they're not dead, they're alive, and they wish the viewers to engage. And they, and one of the problems for all of us, and even us in the profession, you can walk around something like the Prado, and one of the things you're fighting is this kind of haze that comes down with, oh yes, Velasquez, got him, Goya, right, got. And you know, you can end up accommodating the works rather than engaging with them. And of course, this is one of the strategies that, or you know, how critical it is to put in terms of display, and of also, of course, the games contemporary artists play with regard to the floor, the wall, new media, the desire to reach out to an audience and to insist that they locate this work somehow in. A personal experience.
We had a work in here in the previous space which was largely white, can't remember whose it was, but with a bit of ripple of colour, and we caught a child licking it.
Perfect. What is an artwork taste of?
Did you tell them to stop?
That's correct. I've heard of a much lewd example of that, which I won't repeat. In fact, if anyone goes to Bilbao and sees the Big Richard series there, they should ask the guards about that. But I won't.
They're fantastic. Yes.
There are some stories.
Well, John, would anyone like to ask John another question? I think this is probably a really good place to thank you for your generosity. But if there's anyone who'd like to ask, yes, Neil.
I'm just wondering about the different colours you've used, and,
yep.
And on some canvases there are blends of colours. There are more than one colour. I'm just wondering, is that totally random, or is there some kind of rhyme or rhythm operating there?
Well, there's a sort of a dumb rhythm where I tried to use, I'm a great fan of metallics, so slightly elusive tones and things, and so I've used this kind of, there's a kind of a visual glue where the metallics, the silvers, the bronzes, and those kind of strange colours with the silver are kind of a baseline in the work, and the high, the top notes, the gigor kind of fluoro oranges and that are supposed to be are intended to be punchier kind of notes. But what I'm trying to, I guess, is assert any book that attempts to sum up or collate the vocabulary of art terms also requires the full horror in terms of colour spectrum. So, you know, as I say, it's a sort of a gigor coloration, and I wanted to step out of my own kind of colour spectrum, I suppose, as an artist, and use the whole paint box, which is a luxury as a painter I'm allowed. And so I surprised myself in some way with going a little bit too far with some of the multi-tonal ones, where the term that's written on them collapses a little under the weight of the painterly thing. So it's, I guess, there's a sort of a, I'm trying to present an architecture of the world here in some strange way, a mini little Manhattan of experience and of language. So that was played out with as many colours as I could possibly use, and some of them, I tell you, are awful, so that was a great pleasure.
Well, thank you very much, John. We've done it.
Good, excellent.